This week, an exciting announcement about the South Pasadena Masonic Lodge's Illumination Lecture Series. I'll be presenting on the 6th of February. All the details coming up. Then, in a paper regarding all things about the great work of speculative Freemasonry, we examine a Masonic article about the great work of speculative Freemasonry and Dr. George Oliver's essay. Where does Freemasonry come from? What is the underlying allegorical significance of its mythological Egyptian origins? And are we truly tied to Rosicrucianism? Then we'll take a contemplative look at the mundane portion of our lives relating to working hard and making money. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
This is episode number 579. As always, we want to go ahead and celebrate our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners for making this show possible. We've been doing this show since July of 2011. No small endeavor, but again, every bit helps. And there are some contributors out there who have just made a world of difference, whether you decide to support us on a monthly basis or even if you just do a one-time gift. All of that is really appreciated, and it helps us get everything done. If you want to learn more about how you can support the show, head on over to wcypodcast.com, click on Support the Show. You can also check out the shop as well as the bookstore, which contains Amazon affiliate links to books, which include my personal recommended reading and listening lists, books by those who have been on the show, and even recommendations from some of our guests. As far as presentations, well, here we are. On the 31st of the month of January, I'll be at Alvin A. Crump, Allied Masonic Degrees, just having some fellowship, and I'll be talking a little bit about Masonic Week, which answering questions and things of that nature related to the Allied Masonic Degrees. And of course, Masonic Week is coming up in February. February 8th through the 12th. So I know hotels are filling up fast, but there's a lot to do at Masonic Week, even if you're not in every single body. Of course, if you're just, I say just, I don't mean that to be derogative or anything. If you're just at Master Mason status, there are still a few things that you can go to. Things like the Philalethes meeting. You could go to the Blue Friars meeting, not the dinner, but the meeting where that you may or may not be witness to a great presentation there. I just don't know if they're doing a presentation, but there's a lot to do. And then just before that, though, we've got a big announcement. And so this announcement is, I guess, 10 years in the making. So Brother Dago Rodriguez of the South Pasadena Masonic Lodge, South Pasadena Masonic Lodge has been doing something called their Illumination Lecture Series, and they've been doing it for 10 years. And just recently, he posted within the South Pasadena Masonic Family Facebook group, and he wrote, 10 years ago, we began our simple talks at Lodge to understand our craft better. Little did we imagine that 10 years later, we would still be kicking strong. The team is excited to celebrate our 10-year anniversary. 10 new monthly talks, 10 new speakers, 10-year anniversary festive board. The Illumination Lecture Series. He said, stay tuned for more details. Now, they had a team meeting just a few days ago, and I had a little bit of advanced knowledge about this. They've invited me to be the February speaker. So, what does that mean? It means, on February 6th, I will be at South Pasadena Masonic Lodge. And I'll be talking on a topic that is really important to me, something that I've had a huge interest in, both philosophically and Masonically. One could argue that philosophy and Freemasonry are different. However, I've always felt they are the same, or at least very closely related. The topic I'm going to present on is Friedrich Nietzsche's Übermensch and the Royal Art, as in Freemasonry. The philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche has changed the world. His approach to individual responsibility and the progress of humanity was stark and uncomforting at times. His idea of a perfect man, or the overman, the Übermensch, can almost be seen as blasphemous within religious circles. Similarly, making oneself better through experience and perspective is exactly what Freemasonry calls us to do and is in simpatico with religious viewpoints. So in this lecture, we're going to explore these concepts and their interrelations, And so I don't want to give away too much, but I think you all will be interested in taking a look at Friedrich Nietzsche's idea of the Übermensch, the Overman, the Superman, and the idea of Freemasonry and what we are called to do. So I invite you to come to South Pasadena Masonic Lodge on February 6th, 2023 for the Illumination Lecture Series. Details I will post on our website under the presentation schedule, but I know you'll see them and I'll share them as well on Facebook and Instagram and all of those things. So thanks again, and a huge thanks goes out to SPML for inviting me out to kick off their 10-year Illumination Lecture Series. Now, before we dive into the education for this week, this last weekend, or this weekend, Grand Lodge of Texas kicked off their annual communications. Annual communications is a wonderful time. It's always amazing. It's great. I love it. But it also comes with baggage sometimes that is either pro or con, and can raise tempers, and it can also bring people together. And just an hour before recording this podcast, our good friend Robert William Marshall, who has, of course, come out to Double Eagle Con, was a premier speaker at Kansas Masonic Con. You know him from the Historical Light podcast, founded by Brother Alex Powers. So Robert William Marshall always has some great insights. And he just put up a big PSA, big block image, said PSA, public service announcement. And he says, "This is a general statement with no opinion expressed on the particulars of yesterday's activity. If you really know me, you already know my opinion anyway. However, I've been contacted by dozens of guys asking what happened yesterday because they left before installation. Every year, an enormous portion of the Grand West leaves before Grand Lodge is over. You hear reasoning like, installation is boring, or the session lasts too long. I totally understand. And by the third day of activities, we're all tired. Heck, there have been years I didn't get to sleep for three straight days because we were prepping food or doing other hosting services all day and night. I know it's a long and tiring event. That said, if nothing else, let this year be an ever-present reminder that if you're selected as a representative of your lodge to attend Grand Lodge, please, please, please do not get up and walk out of that session until the absolute last gavel sounds. We need every representative of Texas Masonry to represent Texas Masonry for the entire meeting every year. Make plans to stay through Saturday night if necessary. If you need help to offset costs or make such plans, feel free to hit me up and I will break my back to help you. Whoever you are and however you feel about the issues of the day, you can sleep in my own bed if there's no hotels, Airbnbs, couches, or cabins left in the city. I'm not admonishing or shaming anyone who left. It has been happening a long, long time. It's a tradition at this point. Not all traditions should continue forever. Please do not put yourself or your lodge in a position of wondering what happened at Grand Lodge. Let's make it a collective goal for all of us. Represent your Grand Lodge until Grand Lodge is over." I thought about this, and I'm not sure. I don't know what happened. Robert and I are fairly close. We're great friends. We've got chats going all the time. We see eye to eye on a lot of stuff, but I can only guess at what happened. That being said, I observe the same thing happening in Grand Lodge of Illinois. Men show up late to sessions every day after getting hammer drunk on Friday night, strolling in late to sessions like zombies. I get it. Grand Lodge is a wonderful time for everybody to get together. 1,200 Masons descending on a city, all or most representing lodges within the grand jurisdiction, as well as a couple of hundred guys from outside of the Grand Lodge of Illinois jurisdiction who come out just to come and share fellowship. I think what Rob fails to mention in this post, and I think it's because he's being polite, is that it is disrespectful. In particular, if you are a representative for your lodge, to leave Grand Lodge before the day is out, or to stroll in the middle of sessions because you were hungover. Something about controlling your vices and superfluities of life, brothers might take care to remember those lessons when attending Grand Lodge. All right. So, without further delay, let's get into it. The Great Work of Speculative Freemasonry, Part 1, Dr. George Oliver. Our brothers, the alchemists, have as their philosophy the great work, a task that is carried on by initiates from age to age. In the first part of the renowned Dr. George Oliver's essay, we examine Freemasonry's role in this magnum opus. Throughout the ages, the spiritual doctrine, which is concealed within the architectural phraseology of our modern craft system, has undergone the influence of many different traditions of the ancient wisdom. The student, therefore, who seeks to analyze Freemasonry as it stands today often finds himself lost in a bewildering maze of various tributaries of knowledge, and is apt to pore indefinitely over a mass of fragmentary facts without perceiving their interrelation or being able to coordinate them into one comprehensive scheme. In this paper, the attempt will be made to present, for the guidance of Masonic students, an interpretation of the Egyptian metaphysical tradition in harmony with the teachings set forth in what are called the mysteries. The Egyptian tradition will then be briefly discussed in light of its transmission and ultimate incorporation in speculative Freemasonry. Finally, reasons will be given in support of the theory, which we hold to be valid, that the great work of the magnum opus of the Rosicrucians and spiritual alchemists is the same as that which is symbolized in our Masonic legend of Hiram Abiff. Thoughtful students may find in the reference to the old wisdom and the mystery tradition an introduction to a great subject, nor should the mysteries be thought of only as institutions long vanished into the night of time. Rather, their reestablishment is to be accepted as inevitable. In years to come, a wiser generation will restore the sacred rites which are indispensable to the spiritual, intellectual, and social security of the race. Meanwhile, preserving the witness, Freemasonry keeps burning the light of the perpetual mysteries in a dark age. If, in comparison with former witnesses, Freemasonry is but a glimmering ray rather than a powerful beam of light, it is nonetheless a true ray, a kindly light, lit from the world's central altar flame, and sufficient at least to lead some aspirants on amid the encircling gloom until the existing quote-unquote state of darkness is dispelled by the dawn of a new era. It is now generally acknowledged by those competent to judge that all of the ancient peoples, the Egyptians, were the most learned in the wisdom of the secret doctrine. Indeed, there are some who would have it that Egypt was the mother of the mysteries, and that it was on the banks of the Nile that the royal art was born. We can confirm, without entering into any controversy on the matter, that the wisest of philosophers from other nations visited Egypt to be initiated in the sacred mysteries. Thales, Solon, Pythagoras, and Plato are all related to have journeyed from Greece to the delta of the Nile in quest of knowledge. And upon returning to their own country, these illuminated men each declared the Egyptians to be the wisest of mortals, and the Egyptian temples to be the repositories of sublime doctrines concerning the history of the gods and the regeneration of men. To the earliest period of Egyptian metaphysical speculation belongs the fable of Isis and Osiris, and we find that the myth of the dying god recurs in many of the great world religions. Also, it is an established fact that the life, death, and resurrection of the immortal have become the prototype for numerous other doctrines of human regeneration. The fable, as it has descended to us in the account given by Plutarch, the celebrated Greek biographer, has not been much amplified by modern research, nor has any new key been found to unlock this sublime drama, which may well be termed the passion play of Egypt. Plutarch himself, however, says that the mystic symbols are well known to us who belong to the Brotherhood. And this intimation suggests that the interpretation of the myth, as it is given by him in his Isis and Osiris, will reveal its hidden meaning to students who are already familiar with the principles of the doctrine. Moreover, a perusal of the introductory remarks made by Plutarch discloses that these are of special significance, for if he, by any word or symbol, reveals even a small part of the sacred mystery to the uninitiated, we may fairly claim that such revelation is to be found in the following excerpt from the text of his work. Isis, according to the Greek interpretation of the word, signifies knowledge, as does the name of her professed adversary, Typhon, signifying insolence and pride, a name therefore extremely well adapted to one who, full of ignorance and error, tears in pieces and conceals that holy doctrine, which the goddess collects, compiles and delivers to those who aspire after the most perfect participation of the divine nature. We have in this passage a clear indication that Osiris is to be regarded as the personification of an order of learning, because Plutarch identifies him beyond question with the quote-unquote holy doctrine, or in other words, the mystery tradition. Hence, we may further deduce that since, in the Egyptian system, Jehuti or Thoth personifies the whole sphere of knowledge, and it was through Thoth that Osiris came into being, so Osiris embodies the secret and sacred wisdom reserved for those who were proficients in the ancient rites. To the elect, therefore, Osiris represented primordial knowledge, and he signified not only divine at-one-ment with the Absolute, which is the end of all illumination, but by his life, death, and resurrection, he also revealed the means by which mortal consciousness could attain that end. Stated alternatively, the personality of Osiris typifies the institution erected by the ancients in order to perpetuate the deathless truths of the soul. We will next examine the Egyptian historical tradition. According to this, Osiris is the first of the five children of the goddess Nut. He therefore corresponds with the first of the five divine kings of China, and the five exoterically known as Dhyana Buddhas of Lamaism. The five children of Nut are otherwise the five traditional root races which have populated the five continents, which have appeared upon the earth. Isis is represented as being born on the fourth day, and is connected with the fourth race populating Atlantis. See Plato's Timaeus and Critias. The tradition of Osiris, the primitive revelation of the first race, coming into Egypt through the Atlantean mystery school of which Isis is the symbol. From the Egyptian account of the reign of Osiris as king, we glean the following philosophical history. There was a time, the Golden Age, when truth and wisdom ruled the earth, and this aristocracy of wisdom was a benevolent despotism, in which men were led to a nobler state of being by the firm, kindly hand of the enlightened sage. This was the dynasty of the mythological priest kings, who were qualified to govern humanity by reason not only of temporal, but of divine attributes through his priests. Osiris's representative of the hidden tradition ruled the entire world by virtue of the perfection resident in that tradition. If then, we may concede that Osiris is the positive pole of the universal life agent, Isis becomes the receptive pole of that activity. He is the doctrine, she is the church, and, as in Christianity, it is customary to refer to the church as the bride of Christ. So, in ancient Egypt, the institution of the mysteries was the Great Mother, the consort of heaven itself. From this interpretation, we gain a deeper insight into the symbolism of the whole Osirian cycle. Isis signifies the temporal order of the priesthood, the cumulative body of initiates. She is personified as the temple. She is the mother of all good, the protectress of the right, patron of all improvement. She ensures nobility, inspires virtue, and awakens the nobler passions of the soul. Like the moon as reflector, she shines only with the light of her sovereign sun, even as the temple can only be illuminated by its indwelling truth. In the Egyptian metaphysical system, Typhon, the conspirer against Osiris, is the embodiment of every perversity. He is the negative creation, the Ahriman of Zoroaster. He is black magic and sorcery, the Black Brotherhood, and his wife, Nephthys, is the institution through which he manifests. The traditional history relates that Typhon lured Osiris into the Ark of Destruction, stated to be its chest or coffin, the symbol of material organization, the imprisonment of the soul in the physical body. At a time when the sun entered the house of Scorpio, the 17th day of the second month of the Egyptian year, corresponding to the month of November in our calendar. Hence we know him to be the type of the eternal negative, the betrayer of the Lord, namely Judas. In the initiation rites, Typhon is also the tester or trier, the Lord who is against us, personifying ambition, the patron of ruin. Typhon was assisted in his impious design to usurp the throne of Osiris by Aso, the queen of Ethiopia, and 72 other conspirators. These conspirators represent the three destructive powers, the three ruffians which are preserved to modern Freemasonry as the murderers of the Master Builder. They are ignorance, superstition, and fear. Thus the advent of greed and perversion marked the end of the Golden Age, and with the death of Osiris, Typhon forthwith ascended the throne as the regent of the world. It is further narrated that in consequence of the material organization of the social sphere, which followed upon the exile of truth to the invisible world, Isis, the mother of the mysteries, was so defiled and desecrated by the profane that her sages and prophets were forced to flee into the wilderness to escape the machinations of the evil one. At this stage, Isis, now represented by the scattered but still consecrated body of initiates, began the great search for the secret that was lost. And in all parts of the world, the virtuous in grief and distress raised their hands to the heavens, pleading for the restoration of the reign of truth, continuing their search in all parts of the earth. And throughout innumerable ages, the congregation of the just at last rediscovered the lost arcana and brought it back with them, rejoicing to the world over which it once ruled. In this manner, we learn Isis, by magic, the initiated priests were magicians, resurrected the dead god, and through union with him, brought forth an order of priests under the collective title of Horus. These were Herj, Seshta, the brothers of Horus, the chief of whom wore the dog-headed mask of Anubis. Anubis was the son of Osiris by Nephthys, the material world, and represents the divine man, or the mortal being, who rose to enlightenment. Ambition, however, personified by Typhon, knowing that temporal power must die if divine power in the form of truth became re-established in the world, put forth all its might to again scatter the doctrine, and this time so thoroughly that it should never again be rediscovered. If, as Plutarch has suggested, Typhon in one of his manifestations represents the sea, then it would appear that the second destruction of Osiris may refer to the Atlantean deluge, alluded to in the dialogues of Plato, by which the doctrine was swallowed up or lost, and its fragments scattered among the existing civilizations of that time. According to the narrative, the body of Osiris, the secret doctrine, was now divided into 14 parts and distributed among the parts of the world. That is, it was scattered through the 7 divine and 7 infernal spheres, the lokas and talas of the Indian tradition, or by different symbolism, through the 7 worlds which are without and the 7 worlds which are within. The parts of Osiris were now scattered so hopelessly that Typhon felt his authority to be secure at last. But wisdom is not so easily to be cheated, and in due time, we are informed Isis succeeded in recovering all the parts except one, the phallus, which had been thrown into the river and devoured by 3 fish. Failing to recover the phallus, Isis is said to have substituted a golden replica for the missing organ. In our interpretation of this symbolism, we must infer that mankind itself is represented by the fish, the phallus being the symbol of the vital and important principle, and so used in Egyptian hieroglyphics. The phallus therefore denotes the lost word, the threefold generative power, and the golden replica of Egypt, which was rendered alive by magic, is the equivalent of the 3-lettered word of our modern Freemasonry concealed in the Royal Arch degree under the letters AUM. It should here be noted that in the Egyptian rites, Isis, by modeling and reproducing the missing member of Osiris, gives the body the appearance of completeness, but the life power is not there. Recourse is therefore had to magic, and the golden phallus is brought to life by means of the secret processes rescued from the lost Book of Thoth. The allusion is to the restoration of divine power through the regeneration of man himself and the initiation process. Isis was the patroness of the magical arts among the Egyptians, but the use to which magic should be put is clearly shown in the Osirian cycle, where Isis applies the most potent of her charms and invocations to accomplish the resurrection of Osiris. In other words, the magical power is used solely for the purpose of the redemption of the human soul. Masonic students are recommended to study carefully such magical practices as evidenced in the various types of dramatic initiatory ritual. To quote the eminent psychologist Dr. Jung from his commentary to The Secret of the Golden Flower, quote, "Magical practices are the projections of psychic events, which in cases like these exert a counter-influence on the soul and act like a kind of enchantment of one's own personality. That is to say, by means of these concrete performances, the attention, or better said, the interest, is brought back to an inner sacred domain, which is the source and goal of the soul. The inner domain contains the unity of life and consciousness, which, though once possessed, has been lost and must now be found again. End quote. In the Egyptian rites, Horus is the savior, avenger, son of Isis, conceived by magic, the ritual, after the brutal murder of Osiris. Hence, he is the posthumous redeemer. The destruction of Typhon is to be accomplished by Isis through her immaculately conceived son, Horus, which is a term concealing the collective body of the perfected adepts, who were, quote-unquote, born again, out of the womb of the mother Isis, the mystery school. We can apply this analogy to our great modern system of initiation, which has certainly perpetuated the outer form of the ancient rites. Freemasonry as an institution in this sense, the modern Isis, the mother of the mysteries, from whose dark womb the initiates are born in the mystery of the second or philosophic birth. Similarly, all Masonic adepts, Master Masons, are, by virtue of their participation in the rites, figuratively speaking, sons of the widow. They are offspring of the institution widowed by the loss of the living word, and theirs is the eternal quest they discover by becoming. The metaphysical significance of the death and resurrection of the Egyptian demigod has, for the most part, been lost to the craft, notwithstanding the undoubted fact that Masonic scholars of the caliber of Pike, Mackey, and Oliver are in general agreement as to a definite association between the legend of Osiris and the drama enacted in the third degree. We may, however, attribute the failure of students to recognize the Egyptian origin of certain parts of the craft lodge, ritualism, and symbolism to the transmission of the legend by way of the Hebrews, who, naturally, superimposed their own terminology on the tradition they received from Egypt. In the schools of Hebrew mysticism, the mystery drama of the death and resurrection of Osiris became that of a slaying and raising of a master builder, and the Temple of Solomon took the place of the Egyptian House of Light. With the rabbinical mystics, the erection of subsequent vicissitudes of Solomon's temple provided the great glyph or mythos of the upbuilding of the human soul. And this secret lore also found partial, although cryptic, expression in the Hebrew public scriptures in terms of building. The next important influence affecting the ancient tradition was that of the Christian mysteries, those rites of which Clement and Origen spoke so highly, and as the course of Hebrew history advanced and the stream of mystical doctrine widened into its Christian development, the same symbolic terminology continued to be used. We find, therefore, that the Gospels, the Epistles, and the Apocalypse teem with Masonic imagery and allusions to spiritual building. Indeed, it is these that the human soul is expressly declared to be the real temple, which was prefigured by the earlier historic or quasi-historic structure. While a spiritual chief cornerstone rejected of certain builders is mentioned, St. Ignatius, one of the known pupils of St. John, is to be found expounding the teachings of the mysteries in the following purely Masonic terms. Quote, "For as much as ye are stones of a temple which were prepared beforehand for a building of God, the Father being hoisted up to the heights by the working tool of Jesus Christ, which is the cross, and using for a rope the Holy Spirit, your faith being a windlass, and love the way leading up to God. So then, yea, are all companions in the way, spiritual temples carrying your divine principle within you, your shrine, your Christ, and your holy things being arrayed from head to foot with the commandments of Christ." Ignatius, Epistles to the Ephesians. The pronounced Masonic imagery used by St. Ignatius, who was martyred at Rome in CE 107, tends to corroborate the tradition that the square, the level, and the plumb rule, now allocated to the master and wardens of the lodge, were formerly associated with the bishop, priest, and deacon when serving at the secret altars of the persecuted Christians. Put together, the three tools form obviously a cross, which, on the worshippers being disturbed by the secular authorities, could be quickly knocked apart and appear as builders' implements. The mysteries came to an end as public institutions in the 6th century when, from political considerations, they and the teaching of the secret doctrine and philosophy became prohibited by the Roman government at the instigation of Justinian, who aimed at inaugurating an official uniform state religion throughout the empire. Since the suppression of the mysteries, however, their tradition and teaching have been continued under various concealments. And to that continuation, our modern Masonic system is due. To the early Middle Ages, the inner Christian tradition appeared again in the Knights Templars and the Mysteries of the Holy Grail. And it is significant that these henceforth become associated with speculative Freemasonry. But the most profound influence which went to make Freemasonry what it is today was that of the mysterious Order of the Rosy Cross. The memory of this Rosicrucian influence is preserved not only in the 18th degree of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite, but also, and perhaps as much, in the craft degrees, especially in the third degree. The exoteric history of the Rosicrucian Society commences with the year 1614. In that year, there was published at Kassel in Germany a pamphlet entitled The Discovery of the Fraternity of the Meritorious Order of the Rosy Cross, addressed to the learned in general and the governors of Europe. After a discussion of the momentous questions of the general reformation of the world, which was to be accomplished through the medium of a secret confederacy of the wisest and most philanthropic men, the pamphlet proceeds to inform its readers that such an association is already in existence, having been founded over 100 years earlier by the famous C.R.C., Grand Initiate in the Mysteries of Alchemy, whose history, which is clearly of a fabulous or symbolical nature, is given. The following year, a further pamphlet, The Confession of the Rosicrucian Fraternity Addressed to the Learned in Europe, appeared, and in 1616, The Chemical Nuptials of Christian Rosenkreutz. This latter book is a remarkable allegorical romance, describing how an old man, a lifelong student of the alchemistic art, was present at the accomplishment of the magnum opus, the great work in the year 1459. From the Masonic point of view, it was obviously not without adequate reason that Michael Mayer, one of the greatest of the reputed Rosicrucians born in 1568, exhibited on the title page of his book, Septimana Philosophica, King Solomon imparting his riddles to the Queen of Sheba on his right hand and Hiram on his left. And as early as 1638, we find Adamson declaring in his Muses Threnodi, quote, "For we are brethren of the Rosy Cross, we have the Mason word," showing how intimately the two orders were identified. We also have the latter testimony of Dr. Sigismund Bockstrom, who claimed to have been initiated into the Society of Rosicrucians on the Isle of Mauritius on the 12th of December, 1794, by the mysterious Comte de Casale, and who was left extensive manuscripts setting forth his findings and opinions on matters of importance to Masonic students. The learned doctor describes the transition through which the ancient brotherhood passed in the process of externalizing certain parts of itself in the system we know as speculative Freemasonry. His conclusions agree with the available evidence, all of which points to the fact that one definite group was behind the movement which projected the craft system. To trace the genesis of this movement, which came into activity some 250 years ago, our rituals and ceremonies have been compiled round about the year 1700, is beyond the scope of our present subject. It should, however, be stated here that the movement itself incorporated the slender ritual and the elementary symbolism which, for centuries previously, had been employed in connection with the medieval building guilds, but it gave to them a far fuller meaning and a far wider range. We may regard it as certain that the craft received from this source much that the old operative lodges had never possessed, such as the third degree, with its highly mystical opening and closing. The craft legend or traditional history, the central part of installation rite, now observed in the conclave or board of installed masters, and many other allusions to occult science, mysticism, and even magic. We must emphasize at this stage that our present Masonic system is not one coming from remote antiquity. There is no direct continuity between us and the Egyptians, or those ancient Hebrews of whom we have already spoken. What is extremely ancient in Freemasonry is the spiritual doctrine, which is concealed within the architectural phraseology of the ritual, for this is an elementary form of the doctrine taught in all ages, no matter in what garb it has been expressed. To put it another way, Freemasonry offers in dramatic ceremonial a philosophy of the spiritual life of man, in a diagram of the process known as regeneration. This philosophy is not only consistent with the doctrine of every religious system taught outside the ranks of our order, but it explains, elucidates, and more sharply defines the fundamental doctrines common to all religions of the world, whether past or present. Allied with no external religion itself, Freemasonry is yet a principle being common to them all, admit of no variation. The function of every phrase of Masonic routine, the avowed intention of its principal rituals, and the implication of its teaching is to assist the genuine candidate by his aspiration to find that unity of being which is variously described as the center, the kingdom of heaven, the pure essence of mind, the Buddha nature, the inner self, and the Christ within. That preceding essay appeared on universalfreemasonry.org, and it's titled The Great Work of Speculative Freemasonry, Part 1. There was a Part 2, and both have a byline of Dr. George Oliver. However, what isn't clear is what is Dr. Oliver's writing in this piece and what is the examiner's words. What I mean by that is it's obvious here that there are allusions to things that Dr. Oliver said and things that have happened after his lifetime, so it could not have been written by Dr. Oliver. So there is a mix of ideologies being represented here. What I do like is the breakout, the allegorical breakout of the mythical origins of initiation rituals and their transmission from society to society. Perhaps one of the things that I think is so key here is in the last paragraph, the emphasizing that our present Masonic system is not one that comes from remote antiquity. There's no direct continuity between anything. Brother Adam Kendall, the Blue Friars out in California, has a great piece about the Egyptomania and Freemasonry. And I think he does a fantastic job at relating this great history. But that aside, I thought this piece was pretty cool, the way it ties everything together. Not unlike an Indiana Jones movie, how it ties multiple mythologies together in something that almost becomes a national treasure type narrative. I invite our Craftsman Plus to share any of their thoughts about Part 1 in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group. I'll be sure to leave my own thoughts there as well. But next, I would like to move on to this week's contemplative segment, which we commonly use the tarot deck. For all of those out there who are unfamiliar, the way I use the tarot is much like a Rorschach test, in that each card of the tarot deck, now I should say right now, tarot is not Masonic, it's not involved in Freemasonry on any level of recognized Masonry or anything. This is simply kind of an esoteric part of the show in which we're going to explore some things in our minds. Now, the tarot, in this case, I use it in this way, and this is the way that Paul Case prescribed, as well as many others of his contemporaries, and in fact is the more modern way of doing tarot readings for anybody, or reading tarot for yourself as well. And that is that every single card in the tarot, there are 78 of them, they have stories or scenarios that are attached to the card. And those stories and scenarios aren't necessarily attached to you. But if you pull that card, we're asked to think about things through that lens in our own life. Could this, if this were happening, what does this do for us? And it kind of turns on extra thinking for us. We're now thinking about what ifs. And perhaps that scenario is happening in our life. In that event, it gets us to recognize it and to think about solutioning and things of that nature. And so this week, I wanted to do something a little bit more fun with the tarot. And that is something I love. I love the show Adventure Time, if you're not familiar. A great show on Cartoon Network. Originally piloted on Nickelodeon, but Nickelodeon said, that's too weird for us. So anyway, my wife got me for Christmas a totally unofficial Adventure Time tarot deck by Catherine Hillier. Came from the UK, took a while to get here, but is so fun. The artwork is so great. So I want to have fun. I want to use this deck, and we're going to use the typical projected meanings for those cards. So let me go ahead and give it a quick shuffle and see what we get. Now the whole idea here is we are going to draw just one card. This is simply to give us something to think about this week. So I'm just going to kind of mix these up a little bit. They're stiff cards for sure, which I appreciate. They'll probably last longer this way. I don't know that I'll use them as much as I want to, because I kind of just like it as a collectible item. But once I draw the card here, I will post a picture of it on or in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group, so you guys can check that out. I'll also post a little review. I think I'll do a review of these on the Wizard of Arge TikTok channel, so you guys can see that if you're interested. But anyway, so here we go. Let's go ahead and fan these cards out. We're going to take one card. I got it. All right. And I'm going to flip it over. Ooh, we got the Knight of Coins. So what's, first of all, the Knight of Coins, cool card. It's the knight is actually, if you're familiar with the show Adventure Time, it's Lemon Grab, who is the Knight of Coins. I'll take a picture of that again, and we'll post it. But what does the Knight of Coins teach us? Well, let's check it out. So intuitively, the Knight of Coins, we can break that into two things that we know right away. Number one, Knight of Coins is essentially the Knight of Pentacles. Coins, pentacles, money. Okay, so we've got this idea of monetary stuff, or maybe a tangible item that equates to success. And the Knight. The Knight is a worker. So this is showing somebody who is working towards success. Something I think we're all doing, right? But what else does it mean? It means hard work. It means productivity. It means you're somewhat conservative and you're in a routine. The card that comes before the knight is the page. The page is like dreaming about these things. The knight is putting them into practice. So you're now working and putting these things into practice in a rather methodical way. What this tells us is that we have a plan in place. So maybe in our Masonic world, we are going to be preparing to take the East, or we've just taken the East, and we feel confident, and we've put things in motion according to our plan. The card also speaks to a kind of an individual subjective manner, I guess, in that you're somebody who is a good planner, somebody who might be a person to implement things, particularly large projects. Think about work or a lodge project. Maybe you're going to paint the lodge, or a new charity event that's going to be starting up, or you need to rewrite bylaws, something along those means. You've already gone past the stage of dreaming about the goal. Now you're actually in process of doing the things necessary to complete the goal. The flip side of this is also that it could be saying it's like this, yeah, big deal kind of card. Because what is so remarkable about working and making money and working hard? Household stuff, responsibilities and obligations that you have to outside organizations. And maybe it's saying that you've got some hard work ahead of you, because somebody's going to put a project on your desk and you're going to have to fulfill this successfully. And it's not something that you want to complain or, you know, cry about. And overall, I guess it's the most obtuse, and I mean that in a sense of wideness, the most obtuse understanding of the card really would be that right now it's a conservative way of life for us. That while change may have happened in the past, or you know something's going to change in the future, right now you're just holding the ship steady. And that's okay. It speaks to being on the right path and making sure, or even affirming, that this is okay right now. The card says, if you're tired of it, doesn't matter, keep going, you'll see success, right? And that comes in the next couple of cards, Queen of Pentacles or Coins, and then the King of Pentacles or Coins, right? So, keep on keeping on, TCBing, as the quote-unquote King would have said. That's it for this week. I want to thank the producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners one more time of the podcast. If you're curious on how you can help support the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on support the show, and check out the various options that you can utilize to assist the show. Next week on the show, we're going to read part two of the great work of Speculative Freemasonry. It is a little bit shorter, but not by much. And then we will also do a little thing where we're going to randomly pick a letter from the alphabet and then slap our finger down on an entry in Mackey's Encyclopedia and read whatever it says. Should be kind of fun. And we'll continue with another contemplative dialogue based on tarot. That's it for this week. Again, thanks to everybody. We'll talk to you all next week. And until then, stay on the level. Oh, and to Brother Nick and Brother Brad, the whole lodge of Recovery 31, thank you. But to you two brothers specifically, I'm in your debt. You guys are awesome. Thank you so very much. And that's it. All right, for real this time, take care. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
That's it. Here's your up.